accession number 18719, Real One.
An account by John Carles Ewing of his experiences as a prisoner of war during the Second World War in Shanghai, China. 1900. In the Far East, the Second World War started on the 8th of December 1941, and in Shanghai, the Japanese brought along four field guns and took aim at the little British gunboat HMS Petrel, which was in command by a Captain Polkern of Jardine Matheson and Company's river boat. He was agreed to anything like that. They had full control, and everything was then in their hands. Two seamen of the Petrel came back about 8 o'clock in the morning to rejoin their ship after having had all night leave. They of course found no ship, and they were taken in hand by the British residents on the Shanghai Club, which was immediately opposite on the riverfront. They were then taken up to the YMCA, where many British residents were there, and who rigged them out in civilian clothing, and their uniforms were then burned in the incinerator of that building. They then were told to disappear as far as possible, and that the British consulate affairs were being taken over by the Swiss government, and that the Swiss consul would then give them funds for their maintenance during their time in Shanghai. This, of course, was followed, and these two men were, at the end of the war, returned to the United Kingdom and rejoined the Navy, and I understand that they were given full pay as waiting them when they arrived back in London. All British firms then had supervisors appointed to them by the Japanese, and our part of Shanghai, where the office was under the command of the Japanese Navy. In our office, we had a supervisor. He understood English, but his spoken word was poor, and of course I took quite a lot of advantage from him by not appearing to understand. 2 or 3 months later, he was replaced by another Japanese, but this man had been in America and had graduated from Princeton University. He worked with a Japanese concern out there, and then I found afterwards, some time afterwards in the office, that he happened to be a naval reservist for the Japanese, and that when war broke out, before war broke out, he was recalled to Tokyo, and therefore just another spy when he was in America. He was quite reasonable to work for, and I have no complaints about his methods. He just watched and countersigned everything I signed, and that's how we went on. There was a happy occasion with me. I had very close relationship with the assistant manager in the Chartered Bank, a name of John Irvin. And John told me that the English staff on the bank had an order for 100 cases of King William IV whiskey, and it had arrived at the Blue Funnel Wharf only 3 days before the Japanese declared war. And there was this good whiskey lying there, and they couldn't get at it. And what was the trouble was that they hadn't paid for the thing, and neither they were going to lose it. Well, I heard about the Japanese Navy were prepared to release cargoes in the wharves to German Chinese residents, and nothing to do with the British or American, so I, with the aid of John Irvin, concocted a scheme that his bank's comprador, or Chinese manager, he also had a native bank in Shanghai, which was really a money-lending business and nothing else. And we got him to say that his 100 cases was ordered by the chapter bank for him, and this native bank actually owned this. So I spoke to Kakuda and told him about it, and said, well, this Chinese would be very willing to make 10% of 10 cases of whiskey available to the Japanese admiral if he would release this prize whiskey consignment from Holt's Wharf. About a fortnight later, much to my astonishment, Kakuta came along and he said he would like to meet this manager of this native bank. So I said, all right. So I hastily got along and got hold of in the chartered bank. The Chinese manager, of course, wasn't there, but it was arranged that he would come along to my office, and we met. And lo and behold, the whole 90 cases was released, and 10 was left for the admiral. When, tell me when to start. About a year later, I was arrested by the Japanese gendarmerie. On the 5th of November, 1942, about 6 o'clock in the morning, we were awakened by hammering at our door. And we lived in the French concession, and there on our doorstep was two Japanese gendarmerie. They were all armed to the teeth, and they were accompanied by a French policeman, and he apologized and said that he had to lead these Japanese who was coming to take me into arrest me and take me for internment. I was given a thing to read, and this was signed by some Japanese official who said that I had to take a suitcase of clothing for a change, and also enough food to last 24 hours. Well, it was quite a panic all around the business community, as 300 British, as well as some Americans, maybe about 50 of them, and maybe 24 Dutchmen, and so on, were all interned in a place called Haiphong Road, which was an old Chinese residence with a big wall all around it, and at one time it had been occupied by the U.S. Marines, who had fitted it out with water closets and other refinements of that sort. Well, there we were, and it was a great excitement. Who was coming in? We were brought in by trucks, and of course we knew, all the British knew each other, and there it was. We lay on a floor, it was all tiled, and they were all the elderly people, was five of them, were over 70. They had great difficulty, as their bones didn't fit in very well with these hard floors. Well, we got fed by one big meal by the British community outside, and they were allowed to send in a midday meal by truck. We had for our breakfast, sort of cracked wheat had been sent out to to China for famine, but it was handed to us, and we made a sort of porridge. I can assure you it was very good. We also each got a half loaf of bread, and then that was that. It was all very rough and very oddly. The Japanese didn't know what to do with us. They didn't know anything about controlling any prisoners of war. And there it was. We hung around in idle towns. Then, after 2 days, my wife managed to send to me a mattress and some clothing. And then, to my much surprise, about a month later, the Swiss consul managed to get some sort of arrangement for letters to come in, and I got something like $10,000 sent in, and this was some money in my pocket. Well, everything went fine after that. We all got camp beds supplied, so we were off the floor, and I think it was the Swiss consul who paid for that, not the Japanese. They have no good to say for them. They didn't care a hoot. So then the next trouble was the Japanese, out of pure devilment, they said, no more food is to come in, we have to cook our own food, and then the Japanese would have to supply it. Well, what they supplied was nobody's business. Anyway, we managed to cook what came in, and we had a very orderly way of routing. Some people swept paths, others swept rooms. I was attached to the kitchen. I had to scrub the floor and clean it with a party of 12 in the kitchen. This was, there was no soaps or cloths. We just sort of swirled it down with some water, and we managed to find brushes somewhere, and we washed out the water. This was the sweeping of the floor. But by this sort of thing, I was all right. I had a water bottle, which was part of my refrigerator my wife had sent in to me, and it was a hot-cold type. It could take cold water, it could take boiling water. And working in the kitchen, I got this water bottle filled up at night with hot water bottle, and there it was. When we tucked into bed, my hot water bottle went all around all the various in the room, all the people in the room, and we managed to keep warm. Well, this went on, and everything went fine, and we had a certain amount of relaxation. We had a game of softball, a sort of superior around us, and we managed to play this game, and also cards. We wheeled away the time with cards. The Japanese were hot on rumors. They said that we had some sort of wireless installations in this camp, but they searched, but nobody had any wireless installations or any receiving sets. But then they put in 5-watt lamps, and that was terrible. It would have been better without any. This was to save electricity. They were very short of this thing. Then we had a lot of smart people in the camp, electrical people attached to the power station, and they made immersion heaters with a bit of bamboo and sort of high resistance wires, and we all had these very good thermos flasks. They would probably hold about 5 pints, and we used to dip these in, tap into the electricity, and we heated our thermos flasks with that. Then the Japanese couldn't understand why the consumption of electricity in the place was so high, and they made themselves very uncomfortable for us. They searched and researched, but we had some clever fellows who said, now we will slow down the meters by blowing in dust or flour into the meters, and this slowed down the movement. So this very slow circular movement in the meter was going around, and we're getting about 10 pound times the consumption out of it. It was just one of the funny things. Another great thing in the camp was every national day, such as the Scots, the Irish, the English, the Americans and so on, we put on a concert. And of course, we had some very good people there, you know, some could write music and others could cop verse, and some of them was very fruity and so on. And we had some very good times that way. The Japanese, of course, they always muscled in and so on. One occasion, the Japanese insisted that we unloaded the truck which brought in the food supplies, and it was just before New Year. Now, we hold Christmas as an occasion, but the Japanese hold New Year, and they have a good time. They got special allotment of sweets and special of wines and so on, but we got not a snifter. But as we had unload these things, we had the strong arm gang who did this, and one of them, a name of Bulpin, he was a soldier and had been arrested somewhere by the Japanese and put into our camp. And he dropped one of these, he suspected it was sweets, and he dropped it on the case, and the case burst open, and all the sweets mysteriously disappeared. And of course the Japanese were very upset. They said that we had stolen them, but they couldn't find them. We had spread them all around the camp, and there was the sweets the Japanese had hoped to get for the New Year, and we had swallowed the lot. About 3 or 4 months after my internment, my wife, Marjorie, and their two sons were granted a visit to me in Haiphong Road. There was a great flutter and so on, and they might have been criminals because they were escorted in with fixed bayonets, and those with revolvers had revolvers drawn and so on. Anyway, there they were put into a room, and we were in another room, and then they joined us for 15 minutes and we explained things and so on and so forth. After this, they were pushed out. They were timed to a minute, and they were pushed out. But we in the camp had a little tea and some things laid out and some little presents, and they were given these things to. Then, about another 3 months, all there was general internment for all the British wives and families, and they were under the control of the Japanese consulate. There was 3 or 4 camps around Shanghai for wives and families and men who were not interned under the military. My wife went to a place called Columbia Camp. It was a country club for the Americans, called the Country Club of America, or Columbia Club, some called it. And there they were in there, about 200 or 300 people. Once a year we had a visit from our families who were taken from these civilian internment camps to our Haiphong Road camp in open truck. And of course our visits were more or less supervised again by fixed bayonets and revolvers drawn and swords and so forth. And again we had a spread laid out. I don't know, our cooks were very good in camp. They could make jam pies and tarts and all sorts of fancy sweets, and we had the sugar, I don't know where it came from, but mysteriously produced when wives came to visit us. And there they were. But we never had a meal together. We were ushered out, and then they were ushered into where all these foods were, and they just filled up and off they went. We had a monthly letter, which was like Red Cross through the Swiss consul, and we were limited to 25 words. Whether these letters were censored or not, we don't know, but we understood they were censored. And I don't know of anyone ever having had a letter destroyed by anybody. Then we had a very fine doctor in our camp, a Dr. Sturton. He was a missionary doctor in charge of the China Inland Mission Hospital at Hangzhou. I believe there was some 5,000 beds in this hospital. Well, Sturton was a tremendous man. He did his best for us. He had no drugs, no nothing, but it was amazing what he could do, because the Japanese didn't trust their own doctors. They wanted Sturton to attend to them when they had aches and pains and so on. And Sturton, of course, very cleverly, quite a diplomat, I do this. And then when he wanted something, he reminded the Japanese colonel and that sort of thing, what he did for them, that he should do something for Dr. Sturton. So one of the things that Sturton managed to get was a payment of milk for our elderly people. And some of them had a pint of milk a day. Well, we had to pay for it, but this was a great concession. And Sturton, of course, screwed the Japanese to permit this, because he attended to them on their ailments. So full marks to Dr. Sturton. I have nothing but good to think of him. He was a wonderful man, did all sorts of things. Then, of course, we had all sorts of trouble in the camp, where the Japanese gendarmerie called and took out one or two members out, and they took them down to a place called Bridge House. And they were interrogated and tortured. And some of them were away for a long time. And one man came back, Bill Hutton. He was in the police, and apparently he was charged by sending notes over the wall to outsiders, and this was against the rules as far as the Japanese were concerned, and he was taken out. And 2 months later he came back, and Dr. Sturton said he was dehydrated and had all torture marks, and Bill Hutton died. He never got over the torture and that. There was one or two others were taken out and interrogated by these gendarmerie people, but they were not long. They came back with, and they never spoke very much, and said, well, they were tortured, but what it was all about, it was all just somebody outside, Chinese or Japanese, said, this man, he's a spy, and of course out comes the gendarme and they take them out. And that part of the story is quite well known all over the Far East. Then we Americans were repatriated, and the Canadians. Why they got away and we didn't, I don't know. But anyway, they were lucky enough to get away. And a friend of mine, got the address from me, and he wrote to Marjorie's mother and said, well, he was in camp and we're quite happy and so on. And we're doing that. We're not tortured, but we're living up to it, and got over the life of boredom and sort of managed to get life in quite well by these standards. Then we had the... put it off, Elsie. We had 3 or 4 elderly businessmen in the camp. One was Bishop Curtis, a terrific man. He might have been religious, but there was no signs of it in the camp. He tackled the dirtiest job. He was tough, even in the winter time when the temperature was 18 degrees Fahrenheit. There, the bishop would be standing under a cold shower, having a rub down and saying softies to us who just shivered when we looked at him. Tim Gwynn, an oldest chap, 70-odd, he was a rather feeble type. He felt the cold very much, but we were amazed he managed to live through the internment, and he was repatriated after the war to England. I don't think he lived very long afterwards, but anyway, he came through the thing. Then we had Eric Muller, who was a millionaire shipowner in China, and he lived through it all. And we can't understand, he just in the same rations, but he never complained. One of the features in my way of thinking was nobody ever complained. Everybody was very optimistic about the future. Nobody thought we'd ever lose. And all the Japanese, they were cock-a-loop. We had the old Colonel Dura in charge. He's one of these French types. He was educated in the French Sandhurst as a young cadet. And he had a whisker, moustache, twirled at the ends upwards. And he strutted around like a peacock. And he could speak no English, but his French colour, I understand. Then his number two was a little rat called Honda. Oh, we loved the sight. And he, of course, did everything he could to make things uncomfortable for us. I remember Stoughton turning around and said Honda had got the fever and he was attended to him. And we all said, well, give him the fertilizer and so on and cut his throat or do anything you can. So that was our thoughts of Honda. The staff generally, they didn't bother. They weren't frontline soldiers. The one half of the guard was Japanese and the other half was Formosan. The Formosan people were serfs or second-class citizens as far as the Japanese were concerned, and they were badly treated. So, of course, they weren't friendly with the Japanese, although they had to do what they were told. I don't think there was much more to say about the working in the camp. We had this very big Chinese house, a residence run down, very old, a big courtyard in the centre, and I think there were some 35 rooms in this building, and we were all spread over. There was 340 of us in internment, close on 300 British, and then some Dutchmen, the Americans, of course, and the Canadians had been repatriated, and we spread ourselves around this hard, cold place. I don't know how we managed to survive these cold things without heat, but there we did. We didn't seem to notice it. We got it. I grew a beard because my razor blades gave out, and although I used to sharpen them as far as I could by rubbing them in the inside of a drinking glass, eventually it never sharpened up and it was just mud to shave. So I grew a beard, a full beard like John Player's cigarettes, and it grew in like a brindle dog, some white, some yellow, some red, some black. Where all the colours came from I don't know. And I got my friend Ronnie Matheson, who was the camp barber, to trim it up once a month and so on. But when we got visits from our family once a year, then we had to really smarten up. And quite one occasion I got the clippers all over my face and all the beard came off and I no longer looked like a fuzzy wuzzy. The most amazing thing as far as we were concerned was the Japanese controlled an English language newspaper in Shanghai called the Shanghai Times, and one of these papers was delivered to our camp daily. Now, the Japanese never mentioned ever having a defeat, nor did they ever mention about a defeat by the Germans, but they did say fighting is taking place in the Celebes Islands and so on, not saying they retreated to the Celebes Islands, but they were fighting there in a wonderful battle. But actually, they were retreating all the time. And the same thing happened on the Warsaw Front with the Germans and the Russians. We had very good maps in the camp where they came from, I do not know, of the Warsaw Front. and all the villages were there, and we had it all outlined on the back of a tabletop which we had in camp for playing ping pong or table tennis, whatever you may call it. And we used to put a little mark there when the Shanghai Times said fighting was taking place in such and such a village or such and such a town. And of course it obviously shown over the weeks that it was retreat by the Germans and not an advance. And the same thing with the Japanese, they were retreating all the islands back from Australia.